Welcome to another episode of Bowel Sounds, the Pediatric GI Podcast, the official podcast of the North American Society for Pediatric Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition, or NASPGHAN. My name is Jennifer Lee, pediatric gastroenterologist in Columbus, Ohio at Nationwide Children's Hospital, and I am joined today by Jason Silverman. Hey, Jason.
Hey, Jen. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing just great. Really looking forward to sharing this episode where I actually came in from maternity leave to meet Dr. Rodriguez Baez in Columbus.
This was very early days for you getting back into the swing of things, but what a great first guest back for you. Noberto is such an amazing teacher, such an amazing gastroenterologist and just person, and a pleasure to sit down and talk to. So great person to start back with.
So for those who don't know, I recently had a child. She's 4 months old now, but at that time, it was just a few weeks after we had had her. And I had forgotten how challenging it is in the beginning with having a new baby and all of the emotions. And I was just really grateful for the opportunity to come in. And that was my choice, but to come in and spend some time with you and with Norberto.
Yeah. And I appreciated having a chance to sit down and chat with Noberto, where I didn't feel on the spot to do Zumba dancing as part
yes.
of the experience. Now, I love when Noberto, you know, leads a group in a Zumba dance, but this was definitely, you know, lower effort for the uncoordinated me.
for sure. And for those who don't know Dr. Noberto Rodriguez Baez, he is a professor of pediatrics at UT Southwestern Medical Center, and he's the associate dean for student affairs there. He won the NASPGHAN Master Educator Award in 2022, and he's considered a national and international expert in pediatric liver diseases and med ed. So he was the perfect expert to have on the show for hepatitis B.
Yeah, and this topic was one that we've been wanting to do for a while. We've been wanting to have Noberto on the show for a while. I know as a med student, as a resident, even as a GI fellow, getting all of the various hepatitis B testing parameters straight in my head was always a challenge. And Noberto does a very, very good job of walking through and explaining all of the different ways we test for hepatitis B, what that means in terms of stage of infection, and walks through what we can do around treatment. So it was a really great episode. I learned a lot still, and I'm sure our listeners will as well.
For sure. Well, without much further ado, on to the show.
Dr. Rodriguez Baez, Noberto, so glad to have you on the podcast today. Thank you for joining us.
It's just a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Jason, and thank you, Jen, for the invitation.
Now, Noberto, many of our listeners will know you from your passionate leading of groups, large, somewhat resistant groups through Zumba sessions at NASPGHAN conferences, and your positive energy and enthusiasm. But for those of our listeners who don't quite know you yet or don't know your background, we're going to start with a challenging question. How would you describe yourself in one sentence?
One sentence. I mean, that's a tough one, but if I have to use one sentence, I will say that I'm just a lucky guy that is grateful for all the great opportunities that I have had and in my life because of people around me believe in me.
That's
what
great.
I will say.
Oh, yeah, that's awesome. Definitely one sentence, and we believe that this is going to be an excellent podcast, too. So you're in Dallas, right, in Texas.
Yes.
Tell us what one thing is that we have to do when we come visit.
Oof, maybe dance with me, go
yeah.
to do Zumba there, but I could take that to you. But there's so many great things in Dallas. It will be hard to choose one, but if there is two things that I will say the tourists need to do. One of them is to visit a place called Dallas Arboretum. It's a botanical garden. There's a lot of beautiful outdoor attractions, and there is a lot of displays of seasonal flowers and trees. They do research also. And one cool thing of that is that every Thursday they have what is called Cool Thursday Concert. So they have a lot of local bands playing, and you could sit very nice there in the grass and near the flowers and trees, and also at the lake. You have a lake view also, so it's really nice.
Wow. So definitely come on a Thursday if you're going to Dallas. What's the second thing?
Then the second thing, then you have to come Thursday and Friday, because in terms of restaurant, there's one called Gloria's Restaurant. It's very colorful, and it's a bar that have authentic food from El Salvador, from Central America. There's also Tex-Mex and Mexican. And they actually are famous for very flavor and very delicious dessert called tres leches. But what I like the most is when the dinners end, is that when the party begins.
Oh.
Because then they have Latin bands and DJs that they basically throw down the hottest dance tricks.
Oh, fun. Do you do your Zumba moves on the dance floor?
I do, but I have a lot of pressure when I have to dance in front of other Latinos, because then I got to be really sure that I don't mess up in the steps.
But, oh, that's true.
But I do have fun, and my wife helped me with that, keeping me on track.
Oh, that sounds so fun.
So our listeners need to come basically for an entire week to Dallas.
Yeah,
so
for sure.
That's good.
And if you are doing only 2 days, then Thursdays and Fridays.
Okay, Thursdays and Fridays. Sounds that's true. That'll be cheaper flights too, because it'll be a weekday flight. So
true.
Yeah. Anyway, moving on.
So Norberto, first of all, congratulations on the Education Excellence Award.
Oh yeah, the Education Award from last year at NASFAGAN. That was so nice.
No, I mean it was really, you know, an honor that to receive that Master Educator Award. I mean, I'm humbled because my colleague thought that I was good enough to for that special award. And naturally, speaking of award, congratulations on your award.
Oh.
I'm so excited for you guys. I was thrilled when I heard that you guys are going to be the recipients of the Terry Lee Award this year.
Oh, so thank congratulations. You. Thank you very much.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great honor for us, but we're just grateful to have a master educator on our podcast to help educate our listeners.
That's true.
And we've been wanting to have you on the podcast for a long time. And finally, today's the day.
Thank you.
And we're going to be talking about hepatitis B. But before we get started talking about that, we wanted to know, how is it that you developed your passions both for education, clearly, and as well for liver disease?
I would say for education, ever since I was a kid growing up, I maybe recall myself being enthusiastic about learning and teaching others. I'm the oldest of five kids. So we are Norberto, Gilberto, Wilberto, Alberto. And my sister is Joely. So I remember teaching them and since they're younger than me. But always I found for some reason this sense of fulfillment when I was helping others if they were having difficulties in the schools and teaching them. As I grow older than in medical school, I remember also trying to find different ways to engage people to teaching. I like also to use non-traditional ways to teach. That's how GI Jeopardy came along. I remember I started that as a fellow in Stanford and noticed that the audience was very engaged, that people were really having fun while they were learning.
Mm-hmm.
And that led me to develop other games like Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? Or Who Wants to Be a Jillionaire? And things like that. So it's a way for me to teach, but it's also a way to learn. So that passion continued then helping residents and helping fellows. And I did the fellowship training. I was a program director for 20 years until I moved now into a more leadership role within the medical school. When it comes to liver diseases, I will never thought that I will fell in love with liver. As a matter of fact, I actually thought that liver was very complicated, and that was the part that I was the scared the most within GI. I did my training at Stanford University. They were very strong for liver transplantations and also for hepatology. And seeing the passion of some of my mentors, like Dr. William Berquist, Dr. Kenneth Scott, that was for me very inspiring. And then see the way they were taking care of patients, kind of like drew my attention to that. Mm-hmm. So I will say that that's how my passion developed into liver diseases, and having mentors outside of Stanford like Dr. Reggie Gonzalez in Orlando, that also helped me get into research related to liver diseases. And that's how my passion grew. So it just was totally unexpected. And perhaps a tip for the students and fellows is to always be open to new opportunities. You never know where you could end just because you follow your lead and follow a door that was open for you.
Well, now with your passion for teaching and the passion for liver disease that we can feel this energy even right now, I'm sure you probably have students and trainees who are developing the passion by working with you.
Yes, you know, that's one of the best reward that we have as teachers and mentors is to see how well our trainees do. I mean, I always tell them my success is seeing your success. Mm-hmm. That's how I feel that I have done my work. And some of them are doing fantastic things in liver diseases, in other areas also within GI, and also in medical education. Several of them are leadership positions at the respective training places.
That's awesome. So today we're going to talk about a very specific liver disease, which is hepatitis B. And I don't know about you, Jason, but this is something that I've either immunized patients for or tested for several times. I haven't seen patients with hepatitis B, but I think it's a really important thing for us to talk about because there's so much emphasis on this. And all of us in healthcare even need to get tested and even maybe re-immunized when we get into medical school. So wondering if you could just start with why hepatitis B is so important and why is there so much emphasis on prevention?
Okay, this is a really good question to start. So I want to start saying that it's important to talk about the prevalence of the disease. And, you know, the World Health Organization estimated that there is actually around 296 million carriers of hepatitis B in the world. Mm. About 10% of those people are aware of their infection. So, and less than 2% of those people are on treatment. So that is why primary prevention with vaccination in order to increase herd immunity is the main focus of controlling hepatitis B infection. The hepatitis B virus is very, very contagious. So the good news is that the hepatitis B vaccine is more than 90% efficacious in preventing that infection and have very minimal side effect. Back in the day, when I was born, hepatitis B was not really talked about or there wasn't anything treatment available. But in the early 90s, the hepatitis B vaccine became added as a routine part of the immunization schedule for the infants that are born in the United States. By early 2000, they noticed that the rate of acute hepatitis B in children in the United States actually decreased by 94%.
Oh, wow.
So what that is telling us is that the vaccine is very effective. Also, that has made a significant impact decreasing the prevalence of the infection here in the United States. But there are other countries around the world, like in Asia and Africa, that there's still a high prevalence. Going back to the other part of your question in terms of duration of immunity, once the vaccine is given, the immunity of the virus is really long lasting. So for that reason, we don't necessarily need to do like serological testing after the vaccination. And that is only necessary if for a special population like immunocompromised patients or healthcare workers like us. So we do know that the antibody, anti-hepatitis B surface antibody for some people are going to decline over time. But what we are not clear is why around 5 to 10% of people do not develop protective antibodies after the completion of the hepatitis B vaccine series. Mm. People speculate that it could be because of age, certain diseases like obesity, smoking, the presence of chronic illness, and may even think that that there may be some genetic factors that play a role of not developing that immunity. Hmm. Because healthcare providers are going to be, you know, taking care of patients with the potential infection, that's what we test to be sure we have the antibodies, and if not, then we'll get the vaccination again.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
that was a great introduction to the topic and why it's so important and why we are talking about antibodies. And since you brought up antibodies, I think many of our learners have, you know, painful visions of this table listing all the different hepatitis B serological markers and which is positive or negative in the setting of various stages of infection or immunity. And it's a frequent question on board exams or medical school tests. So can you walk us through all of those different hepatitis B serologic markers and how can those studying for exams more easily remember what each test means?
Ooh, that is a tough question, but are you ready for the ride then?
We're ready. Yeah. Take us on the ride.
I would say that, you know, when we do serology testing for hepatitis B, we are measuring several antigens and antibodies that are specific for hepatitis B virus. The combination of those serological markers is what we're going to use to determine the phase in which the patient is in relation to the infection. We're also going to determine which patients have acute versus chronic infection, which patients are immune to the virus, and which patients are susceptible to infection. So some of the markers are, the main one and the principal one is the hepatitis B surface antigen. That is a protein that is on the surface of the hepatitis B virus that can be detected at high levels during acute or chronic infection with the virus. Having that hepatitis B surface antigen is indicating that the patient is infection, although you could have a transiently positive hepatitis B surface antigen within 30 days after getting the first dose of hepatitis B vaccine, but that is usually transient. The body normally is going to produce antibody against those hepatitis B surface antigens as part of the normal immune response. So the hepatitis B surface antigen also is the antigen that is used to make the hepatitis B vaccine. The next one is the hepatitis B surface antibody. So the presence of that one is basically indicate recovery and immunity from the hepatitis B virus infection. The anti-hepatitis B surface antibody also developed in patients that has been successfully vaccinated against the virus. Some of the other markers include the IgM antibody for hepatitis B core antigen. That one indicates recent infection of the hepatitis B virus within less than 6 months and is indicative of acute infection. Less than 6 months is considered acute infection, then more than 6 months is chronic infection. So over time, that IgM antibody is replaced by the anti-hepatitis B core antibody IgG, which is also part of the another one, which is the total antibody hepatitis B core antigen. That one appear at the onset of the symptoms during acute hepatitis, and it's going to persist through life. The presence of that total anti-hepatitis B core antibody indicate previous or ongoing infection with hepatitis B. And people who have immunity to hepatitis B from the vaccine are not going to develop this antibody. So that one is going to help us differentiate which patient have immunity based on having the disease that it clears, the infection that clears, versus the one that got the immunity through the vaccination alone.
That one was the antibody to the core?
That's the total antibody to the hepatitis B core antigen, yes. Then we have the hepatitis B envelope antigen or the hepatitis E antigen. So that one is found between the core and the lipid envelope and is present in both acute and chronic infection. But the main part significant of the antigen is that indicate active replication of the virus and that put the patient at a higher risk of transmitting the infections to others. Hepatitis B envelope antibody, then that one is when we develop antibodies against that the E antigen, is what we call seroconversion. It's happen marking the transition from an active disease to a so-called inactive carrier state. And that anti-hepatitis B envelope antibody remaining serum for life and also indicate acquired immunity. And then another one that we use is the hepatitis B virus DNA. That one, we usually do a quantitative value to determine the viral load. And that helps us also determine response to treatment, because then the virus should start decreasing how we start at treatment. Or if you are clearing the infection, then the virus also load is going to decrease. The viral load also is important because the higher the hepatitis B virus that we have, this seems to be associated with increased risk of progression to cirrhosis and also progression to hepatocellular carcinoma. So in patients with chronic infection, a higher hepatitis B DNA viral load is expected. Marsh, did you get all that? So how to make it easier? So we say hepatitis B surface antigen is active infection, hepatitis B surface antibody immunity, hepatitis B envelope antigen, active replication of the virus and high infectivity, high viral load of hepatitis B DNA, then you have high probability also to pass in the virus and also higher risk for cirrhosis and hepatocellular carcinoma. That was the summary.
The summary. So I think if I remember correctly, I know for sure I've had at least one question about that hepatitis B envelope antigen. That's the one I remember most clearly from my test. I don't know about you, Jason. Do you remember any of your hepatitis B serology questions?
Yeah, definitely. It's always a question of, you know, here is a combination of serum markers. Answer the question of, you know, what does this mean for this patient? You know, is this past infection? You know, what phase of infection? Or is this, you know, passive immunity because of immunization based on the serologic markers? I think that was a really helpful walkthrough of what each of those markers means. Mm-hmm. Because that's really useful if you see that on an exam, but also if you see that in your test results, you can sort of piece through each of those things. I was wondering if I could ask kind of a follow-up question, because you talked about using this to determine the phase of infection that the patient is in. And I'm wondering if you could just give us a rundown of what is the terminology we use to describe the phases of hepatitis B infection. And if it's okay, maybe a rough idea of expected timelines. So if someone has an acute infection with hepatitis B, how long until they seroconvert? How long until we expect them to enter that sort of latent carrier state? I think there are some patients who seem to never really get to that latent state, right?
Well, and I think it's important for us healthcare workers too, because if we're exposed to hepatitis B, then what's the timeline that we may expect to see different symptoms or different things for those phases?
Yeah, usually once you get the infection, you're going to have symptoms that sometimes may be non-specific, that get flu-like symptoms. About 25% of the patients are going to have jaundice, so it's not everybody. So that's what sometimes people don't know that they got it. Mm. Usually what you're going to do is... depending of the time when you got it, how old you were, then is the likelihood that you may become chronic carrier or have chronic infections or not. So age in which you get the infection is the determinant for that. So babies, if they get it at the time of birth, they have 90% chance to become develop chronic infection. Mm-hmm. That is different if you get the infection where you are an adult, because you have a stronger immune system that is going to help you not avoid getting that chronic infection. In terms of timeline, we use 6 months. Like if you don't clear the infection by 6 months, then that's when we call them chronic infection.
Gotcha.
And then within chronic infection, there are different phases that the patients can have. Mm-hmm. And those ones are the ones that we classify immune tolerant is one of those phases. So those ones are characterized by patients that have high viral load. Mm-hmm. The liver enzymes are normal. And then they also have the hepatitis B surface antigen and the hepatitis B envelope antigens. Both are positive. Mm. That's one of the phases. The second phase is the immune active phase. That one is characterized by elevation of the liver enzyme, sometimes more than 2 times the upper limit of normal. Those ones have elevated hepatitis B viral load. They also have hepatitis B surface antigen and hepatitis B envelope antigen elevated. And this, during that phase, if that persists for several months, at least 6 months for some of the experts, then those are the ones that we may consider treatment.
Gotcha.
There are two other phases. The other phase is what we call inactive chronic hepatitis B phase. And those ones is seen on patients that have some spontaneous seroconversion. So they move from hepatitis B envelope antigen positive to hepatitis B envelope antigen negative and subsequent development of hepatitis B envelope antibody and significant decrease of the hepatitis B viral load DNA. Those patients may have fluctuations on the liver enzymes.
That's without treatment. They do that.
That one, you could do it spontaneously, or it could also be achieved with treatment.
Oh, I see.
So sometimes treatment, what can do is accelerate that process.
That makes sense.
That's when the patients have elevated liver enzymes and are in what we call immune active phase. Sometimes we wait and see if they're in the process of seroconverting spontaneously. So some people wait 3 months, others wait six. But if after 6 months, there's still persistent elevation of the liver enzymes and all of the other ones positive, then you consider treatment.
I see. Yeah, that makes sense.
Another
phase, which is the one that is immune active hepatitis B, E antigen negative phase. So that one is the one reactivation. So what happens is that some patients that have the inactive chronic hepatitis B phase, they reactivate into hepatitis B, E antigen negative immune active phase. Those ones have elevation of the liver enzymes that is intermittent. They have negative hepatitis B envelope antigen, and they also have elevated hepatitis B DNA. That phase is usually rare in patients. And one part that I want to clarify, even though that we classify these particular phases, one of the findings that we saw in the Hepatitis B Research Network is that there are a big group of patients that do not really fit any of those categories. So they are in between those phases. So sometimes it's very difficult to label where this patient is, and that can have an impact if we're going to treat or not.
Yeah, and I think we'll get into that for sure. I think one of the things, so board questions and real life, not the same. So we often see that, but of course, you know, on your board questions for anyone who's listening, you're going to have some very specific serologic findings, and they may ask you to put your patients in that certain phase. I wanted to kind of back up a little bit because you mentioned that 90% of infants who are exposed to hepatitis B virus actually develop chronic disease. And for those listeners who don't know, this is my first interview back from maternity leave. And when my baby was born, she got a dose of hepatitis B at birth. And, you know, this is something a lot of pediatricians know. When you look at the U.S. guidelines for vaccines, we always routinely give hepatitis B vaccine at birth, which may or may not be the same in every country. Do you do that in Canada, Jason?
It varies by province, unfortunately. And so it's not universal across the country to do hepatitis B at birth. Some provinces wait until sort of grade 7, so kind of 12 years of age, or 10 to 12 years of age, to start that primary series. And in some provinces, it is at birth, as it is in the U.S. So it unfortunately, it's kind of variable.
Yeah. So why do we, and with 90% chance of, you know, sero becoming chronic carriers of hepatitis B, can you explain to us why is there that importance of birth dose? You know, why are we asking these mothers who have just delivered a child to make that decision of a vaccine immediately?
Yeah, I mentioned earlier that before and after giving the vaccine, there was a significant decrease of the prevalence of acute hepatitis B. So we know that the vaccine is very effective. We know also that giving it sooner rather than later is going to give a protective effect to these patients. If the patient get the infection when the hepatitis B, when they're born, they're most likely to develop chronic infection. So that's what we're trying to avoid. And even with all this vaccination, you know, every year here in the United States, there are approximately like 25,000 infants that are born who are to women that have hepatitis B carriers. So as many as 90% of those infants are going to acquire the acute infection if we don't use the preventive measures, and they can develop then a chronic infection. So getting the hepatitis B during the infancy then is associated with subsequent risk for hepatocellular carcinoma and things like that. So that is why the several organizations like the World Health Organization and several medical organizations like the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Academy of Family Physicians, and also the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, they all recommend immunizations against hepatitis B in all infants.
And that's regardless of mom.
Regardless of mom, because okay. Giving the first dose, there are some other benefits of that that I'm mm-hmm. going to tell you. So giving the first dose during the birth, hospitalization, is recommended because it also serves as a safety net. In addition to prevent a prenatal infection for those babies that are born from hepatitis B surface antigen positive mothers, they also have been studies that has demonstrated that administration of that hepatitis B infection at birth result in higher rate of on-time completion of the hepatitis B series vaccine mm-hmm. and also the timely getting also the other infant immunizations on time. So there is also an effect there that has been noticed.
Interesting.
So I think that's really important when we talk about vaccines. The other sort of healthcare provider provided substance that is important to address, because it sometimes comes up both in real life and exam questions, is around hepatitis B immune globulin, or HBIG. Can you talk a little bit about when should we consider giving HBIG? You know, is that, you know, at birth, for in certain situations, around transplant? Who are the best recipients for that?
Yeah, excellent question. So the hepatitis B immune globulin is given in certain situations. If the baby born is born from the mother that is hepatitis B surface antigen positive, we will give the patient the hepatitis B vaccine, but also we will give him the hepatitis B immunoglobulin. Mm-hmm. Because the studies have shown that given both provide a higher protective, a better protection for the baby in preventing the baby to get the infection. Mm-hmm. If we only give the immunoglobulin or if we only give the vaccination. So that's one of the scenarios in which we will give the immunoglobulin. The key part is also the timing. This has to be given before 12 hours after birth to increase the effectiveness of that. And also important that sometimes some people may forget, they have to be given in different areas. Hmm. Those are intramuscular, both the vaccine and the immunoglobulin, and they have to be given in opposite or at least not in the same place. Like if you could do the right thigh for one, the left thigh for the other one, but not in the same because it decreases also the effectiveness.
Oh, I think I forgot about that. But you said it has to be done before 12 hours, just to clarify.
Yes, for those ones that are born from mothers that are hepatitis B surface antigen positive. Mm. If we don't know about the mom, so there are a couple of things that you could do. You could try to order the surface antigen, the hepatitis B surface antigen to the mother and get the result soon. Mm-hmm. And then you could decide, depending on that result, if you need to give them immunoglobulin or not, in addition of the vaccination. Another time when we need to consider giving hepatitis B immunoglobulin is in what we call post-exposure prophylaxis. And those are given for patients that were exposed to hepatitis B and did not receive prior vaccination, or the prior vaccination was incomplete, or if they have really inadequate levels of hepatitis B surface antibody. Those one also have to be given as soon as possible, and usually not after a week or so in that case. Mm. Immunoglobulin can also, for hepatitis B, can also be given for patients that has been transplanted or received a liver transplantation due to hepatitis B, or if they have history of having hepatitis B in the past. to prevent recurrence of that infection after transplantation. You do that one in combination with medication too. You use some of the treatment medications to also prevent the infection. And that combination of that prophylaxis of the immunoglobulin and giving also the medication after liver transplantation is considered the standard of care for prophylaxis against hepatitis B virus recurrence.
Oh, I see. Yeah, that makes sense. So you reuse both a combination of the vaccination and the immunoglobulin in different scenarios to help prevent accumulating or becoming infected with hepatitis B.
Correct.
Yeah.
So, and before we move on, I just want to interject to correct myself. Apparently, Alberta has changed the vaccination schedule since my youngest was born. And so starting in 2018, they use a new combination DTaP-Hib vaccine that includes hepatitis B. So it's actually included in the primary series at 2, 4, and 6 months of age, still not at birth, mm-hmm. but before grade 6 or 11 years of age, which is historically what has been done, at least in our province. But again, some other provinces do include it at birth. Oh. So just to be clear, we've moved it earlier.
Good
not
job,
all
Canada.
The way to just not, well, Alberta, specifically Alberta.
Good job, Alberta. So it,
earlier, just not at birth yet for hepatitis B. Just want to be clear so I don't have angry public health people from Alberta telling me I got it wrong.
You know, I think we've talked a lot about preventing hepatitis B, and I really want to talk some about this idea of post-vaccination testing. So in the beginning, you mentioned to us that there are certain populations who need to be tested to see their immune status, and that would be those who are immune compromised, healthcare providers who have that continued exposure. I wanted to push you a little bit for our populations within GI. So can you walk us through, are there any guidance or recommendations for which patients with GI-specific chronic diseases should have testing for immunity against hepatitis B?
Yeah, so great question. So the first one, and also because I'm a liver expert, so patients who have chronic liver disease of any other etiology, like if you have autoimmune hepatitis, if you have chronic liver disease for whatever reason, so all those patients need to be checked for hepatitis B surface antigen mm-hmm. and hepatitis B surface antibody to see if they have the disease or if they are immune. And if the levels are low, below 10, then it's recommended for those patients to receive the vaccination again. Mm. That's one population. Another population in which we within pediatric GI that we are doing checking for post-vaccination serologies are the patients who have inflammatory bowel disease. Mm-hmm. And what that has to do is that the standard of care for most of these patients now are biologics. Mm-hmm. And those biologics have the potential of reactivating hepatitis B in patients that may have had the infection. So it is a standard of care to check for hepatitis B surface antigen and hepatitis B surface antibody. Mm-hmm. And if the antibody, again, is low or less than 10, then those patients are recommended to do the vaccination, the series again.
Okay.
And then what is recommended after completion of those series is to check again for the development of antibodies at least 1 to 2 months after that last dose. Mm. If they are normal now, then we will follow them sometimes yearly, depending on how immunocompromised they will be. If they don't develop immunity, sometimes people may that will be the second time that they may have received their series. They may be considered non-responders, and that's when we need to give them advice that they are higher risk for developing the infection if they get in touch or in contact with somebody that have hepatitis B.
So you don't keep re-immunizing them.
At some point, we're gonna call them.
Okay, you're a non-responder.
Yeah, we're gonna call them non-responders. Mm. So there are some of these patients that, let's say, the one that we also check are the babies that are born from mothers that were hepatitis B surface antigen. So we give them the 3 series, mm-hmm. and those patients most likely also got the immunoglobulin too. They are the first dose. Then we will check for the antibodies. The surface antibody after the completion, at least 1 to 2 months after the last dose, to check the antibody. Mm. If the antibody is low, there are 2 ways that you could do it. You could give one booster and check the antibody after, mm-hmm. at least once a month after, or you could do the series again of the three dosages. Mm. If after that they are still undetectable or low level, then they are called non-responders.
Gotcha. So either a booster or the three series again. Is that for all of the patients or is that just for the babies?
For the babies, sometimes people recommend to do the booster and then the series. Mm-hmm. The adults I have seen and the older children, I've seen it both ways, that they do a booster and sometimes they recommend to do the entire series. Sometimes it's easier to do the series because just in case you miss some of those dosages, at least one or two may be able enough to raise the levels to appropriate therapeutic levels.
Oh, gotcha.
Or protective levels.
What about with our other patient populations? So like the intestinal failure patient population that Jason takes care of, or celiac disease, or even EoE, there's now new biologics approved for that. Do we test in those populations as well, or should we?
So for celiac disease, there have been some reports of patients that has not developed immunity after the vaccination, and then they realize that they have celiac disease. So if they make the diagnosis and go into a gluten-free, they have noticed that given that the vaccination, again, they have a good response once the disease is under control. So it's not contraindicated not to do it. Mm-hmm. So, and then there are other populations in which we're thinking that they have any risk of potential issues with the infection, then it's okay to check. And those ones will be also with the EoEs, and there is also some biologic treatment that are now available for those patients.
Gotcha. No, that makes sense.
So, Norberto, you know, with the advent of some newer antiviral medications that have been kind of world-changing in the area of hepatitis C, hepatitis C can now effectively be cured for the right patient populations. Is the same true for hepatitis B?
No, unfortunately, no.
Oh, yeah. No.
So what is the treatment for hepatitis B? You mentioned earlier when we were talking about those serum markers, who were the best candidates or who were the people that you would target with treatment. Can you talk to us a little bit about what is the treatment we would offer to those patients with, you know, elevated liver enzymes, evidence of chronic active infection?
Well, and I want to jump in too, because you also mentioned there are certain patients you may not treat. Can you also include that in your discussion, not to jump that on you?
Yes, no, fine. So, I mean, the ultimate goal treatment for hepatitis B is to reduce the risk of progression to cirrhosis or hepatocellular carcinoma, because it has been shown that the progression to cirrhosis is associated with the intensity and duration of that chronic inflammation of that hepatitis B envelope antigen that remains positive. So it is reasonable to consider treatment in some of those patients. But because we don't have the same type of medications that we have for hepatitis C, they are like the response and how effective they are is 98, you know, to 100%. So that's not the case for hepatitis B. Perhaps it's a different virus. It's a DNA virus. It behaves in a different way. So there are different factors that play into the role. So when we select patients for treatment, we do those ones based mostly on where are they in terms of those phases that I described before. So if they are in the immune tolerant phase, again, those are the ones with normal liver enzyme, high viral load, positive hepatitis B surface antigen, and positive hepatitis B envelope antigen. Those ones we don't routinely recommend treatment. Study has shown that they are not really respond to treatment. And if we give them treatment during that phase, we may be putting them to a higher risk of developing resistance to future treatment. Mm. So the only way that we may do treatment on those patients will be under a research study. Mm. But routinely practice, patients in the immune tolerant phase, we will not give them treatment. The other phase is the hepatitis B surface antigen positive immune active phase. This one, again, hepatitis B surface antigen and hepatitis B envelope antigen, both are positive, high viral load, but this one has elevation of the aminotransferases at least two times or more, the upper limit of normal. For those one, we'll wait 3 to 6 months, and if there is persistent elevation of the liver enzymes, those ones, we will consider treatment. Sometimes on those ones, what we'll do, we may require liver biopsy to determine the degree of inflammation and to determine also the amount of fibrosis. And that can also help us guide if a treatment will be beneficial in that particular patient. The third phase is the one that we call inactive chronic hepatitis B phase. That one have liver enzymes that could be that are usually normal. Viral load, the hepatitis B viral load is low or less than 2,000 international units per milliliter. And those patients have the hepatitis B surface antigen positive, but the hepatitis B envelope antigen positive. Those patients still have the infection, but their infectivity is low. So we usually monitor and they don't require treatment during that phase. Hmm. The last phase, that's the immune active hepatitis B E antigen negative reactivation phase. Those patients have a viral load, the hepatitis B DNA that could be elevated. They have the negative hepatitis B envelope antigen, but positive hepatitis B surface antigen. Because the liver enzymes can fluctuate, there may be an opportunity for them to treat, to get treated. Again, we'll monitor them closely. These patients also may need a liver biopsy for to help us with guidance in terms of inflammation and fibrosis and do treatment. So those are pretty much the two phases in which we'll consider treatment. The immune active and the immune active hepatitis BE antigen positive, and the immune active hepatitis BE antigen negative.
And for both of those, do you wait that period of time before you consider to see if they seroconvert, or is there one you'd be more likely to treat?
For the one that we wait for seroconvert will be the immune active. The other one, they have already seroconverted as hepatitis BE antigen negative.
Just
that they still have fluctuation of the liver enzymes.
Okay.
So that is in terms of determining first which phase they are. Mm-hmm. Then the second part is discussion about what possible treatments I have, because there are several medications that have been approved by the FDA here in the United States, but the effectivity of those ones and the duration that we have to give those medications is what is going to determine if we're going to use them or not. So typically the main ones that could be used are interferon, or you could use nucleoside or nucleotide analogs like entecavir and tenofovir. Those are pretty much the three main ones. There are some other ones like lamivudine, but we don't routinely use, or we don't really use that one anymore because they can lead to mutants of the virus and they don't respond well. And also adefovir also that does not have really good response. So the main ones that we're using could be either interferon, entecavir, or tenofovir. What are the difference of those ones? So interferon, the good thing that I know is that it's usually given for 6 months. So we know the beginning and we know the end. The downside of that medication are the significant side effect that they have. Yeah. They give you flu-like symptoms. They give you leukopenia, thrombocytopenia. We may have to decrease the dose. So a lot of side effect that the families do not really want to get into, especially because not all of the patients will respond. The other ones that are more used are entecavir and tenofovir, and more entecavir because it has been approved for a longer period of time. Both are given by mouth, and you do the dose based if they have been, if they are treatment naive, or if they are treatment, if they have received a treatment before, you decide the dose, at least for the entecavir. What we don't know, those one is when we're going to, for how long we're going to, so for how long they are going to be needed. Because what we're trying to achieve on those ones that are in the immune active is to have decrease the viral load, sometimes to undetectable, then have them change from seroconvert from hepatitis B E antigen positive to negative, and then developing the, and they need to develop the hepatitis B E antibody. And then after that, then we usually do a consolidation phase of at least 6 to 12 months additional time of treatment to be sure that the disease is under control. So I have patients that have taken several years to
kind of get to that spot.
To get to that, and some others, you know, may not even get there. So it's a commitment that the, that you have to discuss. Fortunately enough, there's not significant side effect. There are some of them, like tenofovir, that could have some issues with the kidneys, or lactic acidosis with entecavir. But if you monitor them closely, then they tend to do well. For the most part, families feel well about giving the treatment, because decreasing the viral load also helps then decreasing the risk of hepatocellular carcinoma and also of cirrhosis later on.
Yeah, that's challenging. I feel like all of these patients need to be followed in a hepatology center so that they can kind of be very carefully monitored through the phases. And with the treatment, what is that risk of having cirrhosis and needing transplant? Is it pretty low? Or
there are still risks, but it's significantly less in comparison, like if you have persistent presence of the E antigen and high viral load.
Then you'd be more likely to progress. You're
more likely, yes. Gotcha. I mean, cirrhosis is very, and hepatocellular carcinoma is very rare in the pediatric population, but we have seen it, and that was approved by our Hepatitis B Research Network, where we saw patients that have that. Not a lot of them, but it is present, so we need to be mindful. And that's another also opportunity that we have to use, or another point when we are discussing the pros and cons of treating these patients.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, Norberto, it was so great to have you today. I learned a lot. I feel like I'm not a hepatologist, and it's not common for me to go through the different phases, and it was very helpful to kind of be walked through them. That was great. I don't have any more Hep B questions. Do you, Jason?
No, that was a fantastic review. I feel like I solidified again.
Yes.
All the things that I learned during fellowship and medical school. It always helps to have that refresher, but the walkthrough was great. I think people who are in training should, you know, save this episode, listen to it a few times.
Yeah.
It'll really help kind of solidify things for them.
I agree. And looking back on your career, what has been the best advice that you've received, and what advice do you have for our listeners?
I think the best one that I have received advice is to always be passionate with what you want to do. And I think that I always try to have passion with every project that I get into it. The other advice that I will give to others, which is another advice that I receive, is to pay forward, to help others achieve their dream the same way that others helped me achieve mine. And I think that's important, to help others.
I think that's really great. And your passion is really obvious to anyone that meets with you or sees any of your presentations, and hopefully is really obvious to our listeners from today's episode too. We covered a lot of ground related to hepatitis B today. If you could give our listeners sort of the three biggest takeaways, the big three bullet points, what would you like our listeners to come away with from today's episode?
Good question. I will say the first one is this: hepatitis B is a preventable disease. So vaccination is key, and awareness of the impact of not of having the infection. So that will be one. Number two will be consider giving treatment to the patient that qualify for them. And then the last one, number three, which Jen just mentioned, these are patients that have complex diseases. So it's good to work in collaboration with hepatologists or people that have expertise in that in this condition.
Love great. It.
Those are fantastic takeaways.
It was so great to have you, Norberto, and in person in Columbus.
Yes.
Thank you so much for Grand Rounds today, for spending the day with us here. Jason, wish you could be here in person. Weather's very hot, but it's pretty nice. It was raining today, but it was a nice day to be in Columbus.
No, it's been a pleasure to be here. This program here is amazing, and congratulations again for the award. And I'm just so excited to see the new generation of pediatric GI doing just magnificent things like this. And this is a great way to connect and with the audience and with some of our colleagues all around the world.
Yeah, that's true. Well, thank you again.
Thank you again.
All right, Jen. So that was a fantastic episode. Always great to sit down and chat with Norberto. He's such a positive, wonderful person to talk to. Do you feel like you've got it all straight in your head now about hepatitis B?
You know what? I love that Norberto actually brought with him a piece of paper to make sure that he had it straight when he was saying it. So I think it's okay to still not have it straight. But for anyone who's going to be sitting for board soon, this is probably a good one to kind of, you know, jump back to.
Absolutely. Re-listen many, many times. If you don't already, be sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at BowelSounds and on Facebook at Pediatric GI Podcast for the latest news and updates on upcoming episodes. And if you like what you heard and you want to support the podcast, it would really help us out if you did one of the following three things. First of all, tell somebody about the podcast. Second, leave a review on Apple Podcasts. And three, on our Buzzsprout page, there's a link to support the show by making a donation to the NASPGHAN Foundation. And you can also get there through www.naspghan.org. And the money you donate helps support some of the amazing things the NASPGHAN Foundation is doing, including supporting pediatric GI research and public education programs.
And as always, the discussion, views, and recommendations of this podcast are the sole responsibility of the host and guest and are subject to change with advances in the field, which hopefully will be coming for hepatitis B.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Bye for now.